Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and our first guest this hour is a man in the thick of political and economic turmoil. João Vale de Almeida is the EU ambassador to the United States. He joins us on a week when Sarkozy may be thrown out of office in France, Britain has officially entered a double-dip recession, and Europe is being torn apart in general over austerity budgets that are shrinking whole economies as they're supposed to control debt. A lesson for America. Ambassador, so nice of you to give us some time. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
From the Huffington Post this weekend, liberal American economist Robert Kuttner, quote, "It's European banks versus European democracy. The more nations cut their budget deficits to reassure bankers and financial speculators, the more their economies shrink, leading the same financiers to bet against their bonds," unquote. Do you agree that the austerity measures being demanded by the banks and by Germany are hurting Europe more than helping it?
I think we're dealing with the aftershocks of the financial crisis. One should never forget that. We are dealing with the issues that started in 2008. It has touched upon and impacted negatively on some of our member states, the most vulnerable ones. Greece is the case in mind. But we're basically trying to restore the conditions of confidence in our economies. Austerity has to do with that. But austerity is not the goal in itself. The goal is to create more jobs and more growth for our economies.
But is austerity working or is austerity backfiring?
I don't think we had a choice, really. I mean, under the kind of market pressure we were in a couple of years ago, and we still are, in order to restore confidence, you have to tell the markets that you are solvable, that your finances are in good shape. Only then can you start moving towards more growth-enhancing policies. And this is what we're doing already now.
But how do you get out of the vicious spiral? More government austerity means more recession, which means even lower tax revenues, therefore weaker bond markets, which leads the banks to demand more austerity, and down the rabbit hole you go until nobody but the banks and the Germans have anything left.
I think that's the wrong choice between austerity and growth. This is the wrong choice.
False choice.
Uh-huh. Not really the choice of should follow. I think we need both. We need austerity in order to restore confidence. And while we implement austerity, we need to create the basis for growth, not bubbles of growth. You know, we want sustainable growth. And for that to happen, third element that I would like to call your attention to, we need to implement structural reforms in our economies. We have an issue of competitiveness. We need to face the challenge of the emerging markets. So what we're doing in Europe, while implementing austerity, while thinking about the growth that has to come in a sustainable way, we are reforming our economies, labor markets, taxation, pension systems. All that is going through a major overhaul, and this is the small revolution that is taking in place in Europe, with lots of sacrifices, but still aiming at creating the conditions for sustainable growth.
So more recession now, you're saying, is the price to pay?
We knew that 2012 will be a difficult year. We hope by the end of 2012 and certainly in 2013, you will see the elements of growth coming back. But it's like in any other family, like in a family of ours, you know, when you have the feeling that you are living beyond your means, you have to do something about it.
But you don't feel that the banks have too much power and the bond raters who helped contribute to the financial crisis in the first place by overrating a lot of Wall Street and other bonds, Standard & Poor's, et cetera, which just downgraded Spain, I think, to BBB+, that these people have too much say, too much tyranny over the people of Europe?
Well, what I can say is that in Europe we're going through a major overhaul, a major revamping of the whole financial regulation, to the point that bankers are saying that it is too much for them to take. But we are determined to move forward. We will make sure that the causes of the 2008 crisis are eliminated.
listeners. We have the EU ambassador to the United States with us, a rare opportunity to speak to Ambassador de Almeida. So we would love your calls if you have ties to Europe, or maybe you're in Europe. We know we have some listeners in Europe via the web. I don't think AM 820 or 93.9, either frequency, quite reaches across the Atlantic Ocean. But via the web, we know that you can listen online. So if you're in Europe or if you have an opinion about Europe and austerity, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for the EU ambassador to the United States, Javier de Almeida, 212-433-9692, or you can post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You're from Portugal, correct?
Yes.
One of the countries receiving bailout money.
Indeed. One of the countries that has been mostly affected by this crisis, like Greece and Ireland. Some people call them the peripheral countries. I don't know what peripheral is. But anyway, countries that have been affected particularly by this crisis and are being helped by the European Union, by the International Monetary Fund.
But do you think the people of your country feel that they're being helped by the EU, or do they feel that they're being oppressed by the EU? We see some of the backlash around the continent.
We are imposing sacrifices on people, and people recognize the need for those sacrifices. Just to give you an example of Portugal, I mean, Portugal signed an agreement with the EU and the IMF a few weeks before an election. The voters went to election, and 80% of them voted for the parties that had supported that deal, and the new government was put in place. So this is democracy in the making, and we should respect. At the same time, we have to respect that people are not happy, that they demonstrate on the streets, and this is fully legitimate. But I think there is a sense that there ain't that much alternatives, you know. When you're really close to the brink, you have to take harsh measures. The question is, do we have the light at the end of the tunnel? And what we want to make sure today in Europe is that we do, is that by moving to and implementing austerity, you create the conditions of confidence. With confidence, investment will return. The economy being restructured and reformed, we'd be in a better position to confront the challenge of competition worldwide.
Let's take a phone call. Here is Jeremy in Passaic. You're on WNYC. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi, good morning. What I wanted to ask the ambassador was that you have referred to confidence a number of times, and this is something that I hear frequently in discussions of the European debt. And what I'm curious is exactly what do you mean by confidence, and how does that relate specifically to economic growth and job creation?
Well, I mean confidence, first of all, of those who invest in the economy, those who create jobs in the economy. Governments don't create jobs. Governments create conditions for investors to create jobs. And I want the investors, American and Europeans and Asian, to trust Europe. Europe is a great place to live, you know, highest standards of environmental protection, highest standard of consumer protection, highest standards of protection of private capital and private enterprise, very good infrastructures, good education systems, labor force, high levels of skills. So why not trust in Europe? We're going through a difficult period. Yes, this has to do a lot with the international economic crisis, but we are doing our homework in a steady and determined way, get out of the woods.
The caller's question was about confidence on the part of whom? You're saying on the part of private investors to have confidence that if they invest in European economies, be they sovereign debt, government bonds, or in private sector economies,
absolutely,
that they will get their investments back. So, Jeremy, does that answer satisfy you?
I mean, it still gets back to the bankers calling the shots, I think. And at some point, as you kind of referred to earlier, that there's this endless cycle, and meanwhile, the citizens don't seem to actually have jobs to go to. So the confidence, it seems like an amorphous thing, and people talk about it a lot, but I don't see how it really solves the problem.
Well, what we want to create is a positive circle, a virtuous circle, not a vicious circle. We want to create confidence in investors. By doing that, they create jobs. By having jobs, consumers are more confident to spend, and we can create a positive spiral out of all this. This is what we're trying to do in Europe. I'm sure we'll get there, but still a lot of work to be done.
Let's take another call. Robert in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi, two questions, and one is to elaborate on that last caller's point. My wife is from France. So I have some some kind of tie of what's going on over there as we visit. But two questions. Is the minister, one of the contingency plans way, you know, not, we're not too much in the distant future? Is there a possibility that they're thinking about the breakup of the euro? And my second point is, again, this issue of confidence. How is confidence going to be restored if alongside of it you're going to have a growing protest and, you know, like hints of street revolution in Europe alongside? I mean, you've got to call austerity for what it is, which is a further stranglehold on the citizens of Europe at this point, of which the euro was shoved down their throats 10 years ago, and it's not working out too well.
But before we get to the euro question, Robert, how would you, and I could have asked the same of the previous caller, argue that they could get into a virtuous circle if not through the austerity? Because if the problem is government debt and they keep spending more and more and more government money to stave off a bad recession, then why is it going to continue to go down the rabbit hole in that way?
Yeah, I think one of the answers has to be that the banks have to be more flexible of taking losses right now on this debt.
Let me get an answer to that. Are you at the EU pressuring the banks, the private sector? You hear the response on the phones. You see the response among the people all across Europe. They feel that the banks are being selfish, that those investors are taking their pound of flesh no matter what, and that they should be forced to more what they call take a haircut.
Well, I don't want to engage in any moral judgment of the banks. The facts are that we have imposed on banks the strictest ever regulation. We learned the lessons from the crisis, and we say we cannot have a repetition of that crisis. We cannot recreate the conditions for that. So we are doing, in a steadily way, determined way, a revamping of the whole financial regulation. Let me come back to some of the points our listener raised. One is the social revolution. I think this is largely exaggerated. When you had the Occupy Wall Street in the next door to the center of capitalism in the world, you didn't say there was a social revolution going on here in America. I've seen no social revolution in America. Of course, we have demonstrations in Europe. Some of them are more violent than others, but they are the exercise of democracy as well, as much as elections are a fundamental pillar of democracy. And again, I mentioned the case of Portugal. I can mention the case of other countries that have changed governments. Again, very normal and natural that people express views.
And we may see it happen in France this week to the socialist.
We'll see what the outcome will be. But the normal exercise of democracy, elections, demonstrations, we are imposing sacrifices. We recognize that. But citizens recognize that they have to go through a period of particular difficult times before things can get better. Again, what we need to give people is the sense of direction. Where are we going? What are we trying to achieve? And I think people want to preserve the major elements of the European social model, but they also realize that it has to be reformed. It has to be changed here and there, because some of our countries, again, were living beyond their means.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you to respond to the caller's other question, which I wanted to ask also. And that is, does this whole crisis show that the whole idea of the EU with one unified euro currency was never tenable in the first place? So stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the EU ambassador to the United States, Ambassador De Almeida. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our special guest, the EU ambassador to the United States, Raul Valle de Almeida. He himself is from Portugal, but he represents the entire EU. And to pick up where we left off, does this crisis show that the idea of the euro was never tenable? That if you have countries with one currency but different economies, ultimately the interests of some collide with the interests of others? Is the whole idea being proven a utopian mistake?
I really don't think so. On the contrary, I think it's proven to be the right thing to do. The question is, This was not a perfect economic and monetary union. We knew that. You know, the European Union is a major experiment in civilization in the sense that 27 countries, half a billion people, decide to join efforts and share sovereignty in order to live in peace and prosperity. This goes back to after the Second World War, the late 50s and 60s. So it's a long exercise that we do in an incremental way. We learn from each crisis and we take another step. So we never said this was perfect. We knew that the Economic and Monetary Union, which is the foundation for the euro, had some weaknesses, some liabilities. So what we're doing now is dealing with them and make it more perfect than it was before. But I don't think there will be a breakup, because breaking up the euro will cost more than keeping it alive.
Why wouldn't it happen again and again and again? If a country like Greece wants to not collect its taxes and go more and more into debt relative to Germany or France or some other country, then we're going to wind up in this situation again, unless there are unified fiscal policies to go along with a unified currency. That's, or is that not true?
That's true, and that's what we're doing. The changes we are introducing in the euro area go exactly in that direction, reinforcing discipline. If you have more discipline, you can have more solidarity. So there's an issue of responsibility on both sides. Those who are weaker, those who are stronger, discipline, responsibility, solidarity. I think that are the key words today. And we are revamping the whole economic governance of the euro area in order to deal with these issues, in order to allow one country to diverge excessively to the point of risking breaking up the whole operation, but rather to prevent a country from doing that through more discipline, but also through more solidarity.
Mike in Randolph, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Wonderful. How are you doing, Brian? And it's wonderful to speak to the ambassador here. It's such a privilege. But
thank you.
I'm glad I got through. But I have a question. It kind of goes along with what you guys were talking about. Are you noticing a trend among the populations of these countries, like your own, Portugal and Spain, and some of the countries that are feeling the impact of the economic crisis over there? Is the public kind of transitioning towards feeling more angst being part of the union? Is there sects of communities or certain countries that kind of stand out and wanting to back out of the European Union?
Right, and Greece has probably been the most active in at least talking about it. And you could see, Ambassador, why countries, maybe even including your own, although they don't seem to be on the verge of it, might look at the austerity measures that are imposed and the other requirements of IMF loans or EU loans and say, you know, this just isn't worth it. I'm going to take my chances. And if it means default today, then too bad. And that's going to be a better way for us to go than being, in a sense, indentured servants to the big moneyed countries.
I think the question has to do how people respond in terms of the exercise of democracy. And of course, we are witnessing political fluctuations in Europe, and sometimes radical change from one government to the other. A few government changes have taken place. We are about to have elections in a few countries of the Union. We don't know exactly yet the results, of course, but it's normal that democracy produces the kind of responses. It would be bad if people would not find in democracy the way to express their concerns and to exercise the capacity to change. So I see this as a signs of vitality of our democracy rather than the other way around. But certainly there is a big debate going on in Europe, and I was very glad to see, for instance, the first round of the presidential elections in France, 80% of participation, 80%,
yes,
which for European standards is extremely high, which again shows that people want to exercise their right to determine their future. And this is a sign of vitality of our democracy.
What do you think the lessons are from Europe for the United States? Because these are the same debates we're having in our election year.
Well, for you to draw your conclusions, but I think that fundamentally, industrialized societies like ours, or post-industrialized societies like ours, they share quite a lot of the same problems, you see. I mean, we have an aging population, we have problems in social security and pension system, we have a skills gap, we have an issue of competitiveness towards the emerging economies. All these are common issues. And then we have public finances. Where are we in terms of deficit, in terms of debt? If I look at the average figures in Europe and I compare them with the figures in the U.S., the United States is in a worse position than Europe as far as deficit and debt. So this, just to say, I don't want to be glad because you have problems as well. But
U.S. is in a worse position than Europe, you're saying,
in terms of
deficit
numbers, yes,
and debt?
Yes. If you take the average of Europe, and you compare it with U.S., yes, you have a higher deficit and you have a higher debt. So these are problems that our societies have to deal with one day or the other.
So
we are dealing with it now.
So by your standards for your own continent, the United States should go into a deep austerity program, a more Republican than Democratic in U.S. political terms approach.
That's for you to choose and decide. I'm not giving you any hint of what should be done in the United States. What I'm saying is that, and we realized that in the G20 when we started working after the crisis on what needs to be done, we realized that our societies had to go through fundamental changes. We are doing it in Europe now. We may disagree on the focus and the intensity of the measures, but you cannot challenge the fact that our politicians are determined to do what they think is the right thing to do. I hope and I believe it's the right thing to do. We'll see the results. In any case, we are implementing it in a forceful and steady and determined way, doing our homework in order to create the conditions for sustainable growth in the future.
Do you ever consider in Europe encouraging families to have more children? And if that sounds like an out-of-the-blue question, as you know, Europe has more of a problem than the United States with a proportionally aging population. The birth rate is lower than in this country.
Absolutely.
And we have more immigration in this country of young people.
This is a serious issue. It's an aging population, very low demographics. So,
meaning more outlays of Social Security in case people don't understand the economic consequences.
Absolutely. And balances in Social Security systems, need for immigration, which only, you know, creates also social integration problems and political ones. And if you see the rise of the far right in Europe, you can relate the two things. So very demanding times for politicians, very demanding time for economists to try to find the right solutions. But a very interesting moment in the history of Europe, maybe a decisive one if you compare with the last decades.
Before you go, to change the topic completely, as many of our listeners know, we're doing a series on this program called The End of War, in which we're examining the question of whether human beings can ever end war entirely. And Western Europe comes up as a positive example, because after 1,000 years of nearly constant war of one kind or another, the post-World War II period seems to have produced a historically unique consensus that you are done with all that. Could you reflect on whether you think Western European nations, and after the Balkans, maybe now all of Europe, have put an end to war with each other?
I think it's an enormous achievement, and we are very proud of it. In the last 60 years, we stopped more than 1,000 years of war in Europe, civil war in Europe. You know, Europeans stopped killing Europeans. And I cannot forget that only a few years ago, Europeans were killing Europeans in the Balkans. Only a few years ago, my country, Spain and Greece, were under right-wing dictatorships. Only a few years ago, all the countries of Eastern Europe were behind the Iron Curtain, the Soviet Empire. This is what we have achieved today. 500 million people living together, 23 different languages, different histories and culture, but still living together, sharing sovereignty, voting for the same European Parliament, taking decisions together, dealing with problems together, with discipline, solidarity, many discussions, long meetings. But I prefer Europeans to fight over a communique than to real fight.
Would you think that there's a lesson from the way Europe has done something for the rest of the world, or did Europe have to so exhaust itself through the violence of World War I and World War II in order to come to this point?
Well, I'm a historian by training.
You are.
I think we should learn from history, but it doesn't give you all the lessons. What I learned from my European experience now is that we have to go through the pains of trying to find compromises. It takes a lot of time sometimes, but at the end of the day, it pays. And we don't want to teach lessons to the world, but I think that in today's world, if you look at Asia, if you look at South America, if you look at Africa, regional integration, you know, opening up borders, doing things together, it's maybe the right way to go to prevent the seeds of war from developing.
Fascinating. And one more thing on that. The U.S. sometimes argues now that European countries should build up their militaries more so the U.S. doesn't have to be the policeman of the world. That's one reason our government has such heavy debt. We spend more on the military than every other nation on earth combined. Does Europe see that as America obsessed with the military or as protecting Europe at America's expense?
we very much valued the support of America in the Second World War and the First World War, and America is very well behind also the European project. It's also an American project, and we are very much aware of that. Now, on the issue of defense and military, there is a debate going on in our society. How much should you put on defense and military? How much should you put on social security? The question is, security is a major asset that we have, and our citizens are worried about security. So the debate in Europe today is, how much can we do together? How much more can we do together inside Europe in order to, you know, pooling resources, have a smart approach to defense? I think there's a lot of efficiency that we can still increase in the way we approach defense and the military spending. And there's a lot we can do with the U.S. also in our neighborhood region to do things together.
Well, we have to leave it there. I'm very pleased that the EU ambassador to the United States, Harold Valle de Almeida, has come to our studio today and spent some time with us. While here in New York, I gathered to talk to folks on Wall Street about the wisdom of investing in Europe.
Absolutely. The right place to invest right now, and we look forward to cooperation with the United States.
Do you argue that Dodd-Frank makes the U.S. a more hostile environment for capital?
We are in favor of financial market reform, and we are engaged in that inside the G20. We are doing our homework in Europe. I hope the U.S. will do the same here.
Well, we appreciate your time again, and I hope we can speak again.
Thank you very much.